It is 8:30, and you are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. And 8:30 means only one thing, that the brilliant minds of Eat the State are with us once again, none other than Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik. Maria, it's good to have you back. What was Jav's blowing Jav's chunks having, on
there? Jav's having a hard time keeping a straight face. We were having a good time joking around here before we went on the air.
I was sort of wondering if you know that movie that came out last year about the guy who was had the severe mental health problems. So that was your Brilliant Minds reference.
No, but we do have some special treatment for you lined up a little later after the show.
I'm sure we do, and opening the paper in the morning usually is a shock, isn't it?
So let's jump into it, because we got a lot to cover in a very little amount of time, which is normally true. But events.
Even more so today. We will talk about Iraq, I'm sure, in the next half hour. But for people who are not accustomed to listening to Counterspin and aren't already trained, you should get your pencil and paper ready, because we will be repeating some of this information later, but there is this enormous, incredible grassroots movement that has sprung up really in the last 2-3 weeks to try and stop this insane invasion upon Iraq. This preemptive, which is to say, unprovoked invasion. And Congress is being deluged. I'll talk about that in a moment, but they can always use a lot more deluging. This is sort of the bottom line. You know, they're going to be voting as soon as Monday, perhaps. So Cantwell and Murray are our two local senators. They desperately need to hear from people. Those phone numbers, and we'll give these again at the end of the program. For Patty Murray, her local phone number in Seattle is 553-5545. Her phone number in D.C., 202-224-2621. Maria Cantwell, local, is 220-6400. D.C., 202-224-3441. The Capitol switchboard overall, which will connect you to anybody, is 202-224-3121. That was the number we gave out last week. And then Jim McDermott's office, you should definitely call and thank his office as well, since he's getting a lot of heat, especially from patriots outside the area. His local office number is 553-7170, and D.C. is 202-225-3106. We'll give some of those numbers on a website later on, but also there's a lot of events coming up. The best summary of events is at SCN, www.scn.org/activism/calendar. The things you should most know about coming up tonight: Scott Ritter, the former UNSCOM chief weapons inspector, is in town, one of the country's leading critics of the prospective war. He's going to be at United Temple, United Methodist Church at 43rd and 15th Northeast in the U District at 7:30. Tomorrow there will be what I think is shaping up to be a very, very large anti-war protest that is starting at 1 o'clock in Volunteer Park. That's when the rally will be. At 3 o'clock we'll be marching down to Westlake. They will be met at Westlake by Congressman Jim McDermott, who is freshly back from Iraq. He will also be speaking at Jefferson Park Community Center from 1 to 2:30. So those things are all going on this weekend. There's also going to be a big vigil and march from downtown 5th and Marion up to St. James on Wednesday evening. But we'll get to all that later. Meantime, there's a lot to talk about.
There is. A lot of it revolving around Iraq. And the reasons that Maria, you're going to go into some of the reasons the administration is justifying their case for upping the attacks on Iraq. Not that we haven't been attacking them for quite a while.
It's the escalation of the ongoing attack,
so
really.
Part of that, I understand, came from the UK, that they're calling
the history of the recent history of all this is first the Bush administration tried to say, look, Iraq has links to al-Qaeda, and then they were laughed at, and then the Bushies said, well, they have weapons of mass destruction, gave no proof of that. And then Tony Blair came out with the what a lot of people call the Blair Report, or Tony Blair's dossier, or or the real official title
they
is...
They don't actually credit it to Great Britain, because Blair seems to be the only one in Great Britain who is in favor of this war.
Right, or who is really pushing for it. The real title of it is called Iraq's Weapons of Mass Destruction. And it's meant to be a summary of intelligence, of British intelligence, and what they know about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. When you read the report, as I have, the first thing that strikes you is that it relies on a lot of pre-Gulf War data, so stuff that's older than 10 years or 12 years.
Back when Iraq was a arms merchant, or arms client, rather, of the United States. Great Britain. Yeah.
Exactly. It also cites the when it cites the reports of UN weapons inspectors, it reads like a real endorsement for inspections instead of for war. It's quite interesting. People should take a look at it. And the BBC, if you go to www.bbc.co.uk, I believe, or
co.uk,
yeah. You can find a copy of it on their website. You should read it if you get a chance. It's very, very interesting. It also reminds us that weapons inspectors destroyed most of Iraq's chemical weapons, dismantled their nuclear weapons program, destroyed nearly all of its remaining Scud missiles, and exposed a very secret, although very fledgling, bioweapons program. That bioweapons program, which the Bush administration has just seized on and cannot let go of as the main reason for attacking Iraq, was based on...
Because they don't have anything else to seize on.
Right, because it really isn't anything else that they have any proof of.
One of the points that we were making before we came on the air was that if there were any actual installations or anything that the Bush administration could point to, that we would have bombed them already.
We would have bombed them. I mean, that's the one thing. I mean, am I missing something? Am I the only person who has had this thought, that in the past month, no one has asked this question, this very basic question, which is, if Iraq had any missile capability, if they had any functioning laboratories, why the heck hasn't U.S. planes bombed it already, I mean, we've been bombing them for the last 4 years, since 1998.
It's not like they have any capacity to shoot down airplanes.
No. So, I mean, it's a farce, really. But the Blair report, to get back to the Blair report, it contained a lot of misleading statements that have been just seized on by the Bush administration and the U.S. press. The first one is the uranium from Africa, and that in itself is quite funny, because the only country in Africa that can produce enriched uranium is South Africa, and South Africa's stocks are under International Atomic Energy control. I mean, so there's no way they could be leaked to Iraq. Iraq did purchase some enriched uranium from South Africa before the Gulf War. So that's an instance where we're looking at information that is prior to 1991. There are other African countries that can produce uranium, but that's uranium ore. It has to be enriched. And Iraq has not been able to get its hands on equipment, including those aluminum tubes that the Bush administration keeps mentioning. Iraq has not been able to get its hands on any of that equipment, and that's because of the sanctions. Iraq's missile capacity, they have no long-range missile capacity. Scuds were dismantled by UNSCOM. Any that are left over are unlikely to be functional. And if you remember the Gulf War, the Scuds were not very darn accurate. Anyway, let's see. And the U.S. and Britain have been bombing their launch sites since 1998, so there are no long-range missiles. There's no missile capacity left in Iraq. And now we get to the one thing that the Bush administration really continues to talk about, is the mobile bioweapons labs. And I have to tell you that, frankly, the idea of a mobile bioweapons lab is ridiculous.
It's the tuna fish sandwich in the back of the car. That's a mobile bioweapons lab.
I mean, yeah, Mike and Job, their cars probably qualify as mobile bioweapons labs. You know, you spill a couple lattes and near the front seat. And,
yeah. I got so many things growing in mind that it qualifies me to drive in the HOV lane. So.
But anyway, I mean, the reading I've been doing about bioweapons labs, you need clean water, you need electricity, you need well-maintained roads, for one thing. You need biocontainment facilities. You need special equipment. You need thousands, literally thousands of trained personnel. You need really, really, really good drivers to avoid U.S. bombers, and truck swallowing potholes. I mean, I have to tell you, I wouldn't want to handle a glass Petri dish full of anthrax in the back of a truck going over a dirt road. I mean, that's how ridiculous we're talking here about mobile bioweapons labs. There's no evidence. The Bush administration has no evidence. They just keep repeating the same name over and over again. Mobile bioweapons labs, mobile bioweapons labs.
Yeah, as opposed to mobile Exxon. Or, you know,
yeah.
It's really astonishing to see the gap between where public opinion is going on this. And, you know, we're seeing, just as I was mentioning before, I mean, it's well over 90% overall anti-war, the sentiment that's coming into Capitol Hill and all the various congressional offices. In a lot of districts, and most of the Seattle and Western Washington districts are among these, it's as high as 99%. I mean, it's overwhelming.
I think it's because people have pretty good lie detectors built in.
Yeah, I mean, there's not just lie detectors, but it's also the absence of anything. I mean, there has been no compelling reason that's been given, and people understand in a way that these chicken hawks do not, that war is not a game, that you're talking about people's lives, that the people whose lives are at risk are not Saddam Hussein's life. He's going to be the last person who gets killed by this. It's going to be everybody else in the way. It's like having Seattle bombed because people don't like George Bush. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And it's much worse than that.
And that brings up the one piece of the Blair Report that is an argument against invading Iraq or going to war with them, and that's Iraq's chemical weapons. Now, the Blair Report is clear on this, and we know that Iraq has chemical weapons. There's no question about that. They have them, just like every other nation in the world has them, which is why UN Security Council members dismissed the Blair Report with a toss and said this contains nothing new. Because the one thing that it shows is that Iraq has chemical weapons capability, and everyone laughed and said, "Yeah, well, so do we." but they're limited to local use in artillery shells and sprayers, and only under the right weather conditions, when they won't be killing their own troops and their own civilian population. However, they can be a problem with an invading army, can be exposed to those, and that's a really good argument to not go to war with Iraq.
Yeah. Well, and then the other.
And I just want to mention one last thing.
I
related.
Just said the other argument with that very briefly is that the weapons are only then likely to be deployed as a last ditch defensive effort, which is also an argument against invasion.
Right. And there's just one last thing I want to mention about the Blair Report is that 2 hours after the report was released, British journalists were on their way to inspect two sites of their choosing that had been mentioned in the report. They had called up the Iraqi government and said, "Can we look at a couple of these sites?" And the Iraqi government said, "Sure, take your pick." And British journalists from The Guardian and The Independent went to visit two sites. They chose Al-Qaqa, a site that was listed as a chemical weapons site. It's where Iraq makes explosives for its conventional weaponry. They noted when they visited the site that it does not appear to be a phosgene gas plant, that the phosgene is a byproduct of producing explosives, and that from what they could tell, it was leaking into the ground. The other site that they visited was the Al-Amariya Vaccine Institute, and I'll just read a quote from what they wrote about their visit to the Al-Amariya Vaccine Institute, supposedly a bioweapons facility. The quote goes, "The entrance to the Al-Amariya plant, a smaller-scale operation with a staff of only 140, has no military guards as might have been expected of a place storing biological weapons. It is run down, its laboratories near empty, and the staff, in dirty white lab gowns, looked bored. Rubbish was piled high outside, especially empty bottles." Now, from my reading about bioweapons facilities, it takes a bigger staff than 140 people to just culture the germs that are needed to produce one bioweapon. So
it's very interesting. Yeah, there are a couple questions that are raised by descriptions like that. One is, why is the media in the United States not doing this kind of work? Because, I mean, the information is all out there. It's not that.
I don't think the Iraqi government would let American reporters in.
Well, no, but you could certainly pick up on reports in places like The
certainly
Guardian
they
and
could,
The Independent.
They,
yeah.
They could reprint. They
yeah,
reprint
they could,
from other sources
they could
abroad.
Do any of this kind of stuff. So that's one question. But the other thing that comes up is there's a real gap because I think the Bush administration is playing on the fact that most Americans have never been in a third world country. You know, hear the idea of bioweapons lab and, you know, you're thinking of a country that looks like the United States. you know, that has, you know, nice paved interstate highways and semi trucks rolling down the interstate. You have no idea what's going on back in that cab of that pickup truck or at the truck stop or whatever. And it's not like that. You know, you're talking about dirty, dusty third world countries that are barely paved, that where economic sanctions have, you know, destroyed the public health infrastructure, the transportation infrastructure. Anything that could be used has been being bombed for the last several years.
Where the civilians are dying from what Bert Sachs, a local person who has protested the Iraq sanctions, describes
as
the weapon of mass destruction, which is a bottle of drinking water in Iraq.
Yeah. It's so tainted.
Tainted with germs. And
so, you know, so I think they're really playing on people's ignorance of, I mean, not even conditions in Iraq, which I think are beyond the understanding of any of us who haven't been there, but conditions in any third world country would make a lot of what they are describing preposterous. And so what we're seeing now is this political tug of war between the American public, which is moving very much in the anti-war direction, and Congress, which is inching closer and closer and essentially looking for political cover so that at least a majority of them can vote for some sort of a resolution authorizing war. And, you know, I heard about this. I was meeting with Cantwell and Murray's aides earlier this week talking about Iraq. And they're, you know, they are very much of a couple of mindsets. Number one, we have to keep the Democratic majority in the elections. That's more important than anything, you know, even a few hundred thousand lives. But, you know, beyond, you know, our jobs are more important. But beyond that, you know, they're thinking along the lines of the political horse trading that goes on Capitol Hill. And we saw this in the run-up to the Gulf War also, where there was a very, very narrow vote for authorization of war, particularly in the House of Representatives in early 1991, or late 1990, I believe it was, actually. And Bush Sr.'s administration absolutely pulled out all the stops to essentially bribe legislators. You know, I'll sign your favorite bill, I'll throw a few billion more dollars into the appropriation for your request for this or that, or, you know, whatever. I mean, you know, they're trading lives halfway around the world for a dam in your home state. It really does come down to that kind of horse trading. So you're seeing the tension between that on the one hand and having to answer to a public that is very much of a different mind on the other. You know, when you see quotes like, I forget her name, but the Republican senator from Vermont or Maine who was saying, this is the toughest decision that I've ever had to make in my life. The decision isn't necessarily whether to attack Iraq, it's whether to defy the will of the public or not. That's
her constituents.
The tension. Yeah, her constituents.
Her constituents who are calling her and saying, don't vote for this war.
Yeah.
While the White House and her own party are saying, we want to do this.
Yeah.
So another piece of evidence that the White House is trotting out there beyond the Blair witch trials is the Iraq-Al-Qaeda connection.
Yeah, it's quite funny. I mean, you have them doing the talk shows, the rounds of talk shows. Rumsfeld said, quote, "We have what we consider to be very reliable reporting of senior-level contacts going back a decade and of possible chemical and biological agent training of Al-Qaeda." That the key phrase there is going back a decade. That's making me ask, well, what are you talking about? Are you talking about information that's a decade old, or are you talking about information that's current? Condoleezza Rice said, quote, "We know, too, that several of the detainees, in particular some high-ranking detainees, have said that Iraq provided some training to al-Qaeda in chemical weapons development," end quote. Now, what she's talking about the detainees at Guantanamo, who other FBI personnel have said are not big fish. They're all little fish, people that were picked up off the battlefield.
And people are desperate to say anything that they think their captors want to hear.
Right, and they've been under isolation. And in fact, one of them, it turns out, may be a cameraman for Al Jazeera TV. That's who they have in detention at Guantanamo. And she's also referring to Abu Zubaydah, the same source of some other false information, if you remember FBI warnings about al-Qaeda attacks on banks on the East Coast that turned out to be false, and the information on Jose Padilla, which turns out to be nothing substantial. That's all come from Abu Zubaydah. And then what they're referring to when they say that al-Qaeda personnel have been in Iraq, even in Baghdad, is one guy. They're talking about one guy. His name is Abu Musab Zarqawi, a Jordanian, who is believed to have left Iraq and then traveled through Baghdad on his way somewhere else. They have no proof that he met with anybody from the Iraqi government, that he received any training, or that he contacted anybody from the Iraqi military while he passed through Baghdad. That's what they're talking about as Iraq's links to al-Qaeda.
And in fact, Baghdad is a major regional city. You would expect that there'd be a lot more people than that
traveling through than one guy. Yeah, and in fact, Iraq has no contacts to any terrorist groups listed on the U.S.'s State Department's list of terrorist groups, except for one group that is an anti-government, that is an anti-Saddam Hussein group that is supported by several congressional members.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
So if you wanted to pick a Middle Eastern country that had no attacks, that had no contacts with terrorist groups, you would probably pick Iraq. You wouldn't be looking at any others. I mean, Syria, for example, has more contacts with terrorist groups. Yeah. Iran, Israel, they all do.
And beyond that, I mean, Al-Qaeda is ideologically opposed to Saddam Hussein and his administration. It's a secular administration. It's Sunni as opposed to Shiite. I mean, there's all sorts of reasons why Al-Qaeda would love to see Saddam Hussein ousted.
When Iraq had invaded Kuwait, they persecuted people who were fundamentalist Muslims. They took men and out into the street and shaved off their beards. I mean, that's how opposed they are to people who have the same kind of beliefs that Al-Qaeda does.
It totally ignores the fact that Iraq and Syria are both run by the Ba'ath Party, which is totally anti-Muslim, you know, and has a rich history of wiping out, you know, Muslims wherever they can find them. So it's just both directions, it just doesn't work.
You know, you made a reference also to detainees, and that brings up the sort of, you know, repeated scare tactics that I think also feed into the war hysteria and sort of a larger zeitgeist sense. There were headlines again this morning about the, you know, five guys down near Portland shooting off, you know, rounds into a gravel pit.
Some more jihadi wannabes.
Yeah, and, you know, that gets on the front page, whereas the sentencing of John Walker Lind gets buried on an inside section, whereas when he was arrested, I mean, that was front page for weeks, and then, you know,
this kid, he's 21 years old. I mean, as a teenager, he decided to do what, I don't know, hundreds, maybe thousands of U.S. mercenaries have done for the last 50 years, to go and fight in a foreign war. That is not a crime.
Yeah. He was fighting in that foreign war before the United States decided to invade Afghanistan.
When in fact we had contacts with the Taliban and had been
At that point, if he decides to desert, he'll get shot. So but you know, even his sentencing that was buried on an inside section, whereas they trot out a regular basis.
And
James
Ajama
being another example of these people who are supposed to be a threat to the United States, they're not. Every time they eventually wind through the judicial system, if they get a fair trial, which is another question, you know, it's going to uncover that it was no big deal.
Right.
All right. Anything else on that?
I get very emotional about some of this stuff.
I think we all do. So let's talk about something slightly closer to home. The ILWU is locked out of ports. Still.
Yeah, up and down the West Coast, 29 different ports. And it's astonishing when you look at what this is ostensibly about. The ILWU, which is the main longshore union on the West Coast, in fact, the only one for the waterfront, for the dock workers, and also the white-collar jobs, not just loading off, but, you know, the controlling the shipping manifests and all that kind of stuff, versus the Pacific Maritime Association, which is the consortium of shipping companies, people like Steve Services of America and whatnot. And the actual gap between the two sides in terms of economic terms is very, very minimal. We're talking a few hundred jobs that the union would like to see with the creation of new technology to sort of, you know, streamline the shipping process.
And at this point, the union has accepted that the new technology is necessary.
Yeah, and what they have said is, if there are new technology jobs created, we want to make sure, just like we have made sure ever since basically 1900, 1934 that new jobs created on the docks are, in fact, also going to be union jobs. The PMA has been balking at this. They don't want to see that. And analysts say that the difference between the two sides, whether new jobs that are likely to be created during the length of the contract are union or non-union, comes down to about $20 million a year. It's peanuts. It's a couple, 300 jobs.
Compared to the volume of work that flows through there and the volumes of money involved, it is tiny. Is a tiny amount.
Yeah, and so this raises the question, which I think we mentioned in passing last week, of what the actual agenda is. And the union has been claiming that what the PMA has been out to do essentially is bust the union. That actually makes a lot of sense when you look at the economic damage, particularly if the strike goes on beyond the beginning of this week. More than about 10 days out is when it really starts to add up. But as opposed to $20 million, clearly you're already talking billions. And you were saying the Wall Street Journal has some lower figures.
Yeah, some economists have been saying, oh, for every day that the ports are closed, $1 billion is lost or whatever. And then other economists are saying, wait a minute, the West Coast ports bring in more goods from Asia than they ship out to other destinations. So what it's doing is actually helping our balance of trade to have the ports closed for a little while. That actually lends a little fuel to the idea that the PMA closed the ports on purpose in order to break the union, because they see a short-term closure as beneficial rather than economically bad. But once you get past the 10-day mark, which is about two-week mark,
yeah,
then you start getting into where you're impacting manufacturers' supplies of goods, and that has some effect
on
the economy.
And also retail distribution for the holiday season. Mm-hmm. So, and once you get into the question of breaking the union, this also is politically for the Bush administration, an opportunity, quite possibly. They may not want the distraction at a time when they're trying to ramp up the war in Iraq, but a possibility of invoking Taft-Hartley and having the kind of a PATCO stand that the Reagan administration successfully used as a sort of a setting the tone for an anti-union agenda throughout the 80s. It really comes down to a setup for a much larger, much more explicitly anti-union agenda than simply a couple hundred jobs.
And a real quick example of one of the things I don't think that got any coverage that the PMA's lockout has caused was, it isn't just cargo that's stopping coming in, it's also the cruise ship industry, which I certainly have no love of, but they weren't going to allow passengers to get unloaded there, and it was only...
Yeah, the ILWU has actually been volunteering to help,
They have also offered to load and unload military ships.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, they have. And they've been making all these concessions, and the PMA is not, and you really have to question what the agenda is. There are, in many parts of the area, the pickets are up and going just fine, but some areas that could definitely use pickets are just stopping by and saying hi down by Pier 46 on Alaskan Way, and then down at the main entrance to Terminal 18 on Harbor Island. Those are places. There are others, but those are main places where you will find people picketing pretty much all the time.
If you want to go down and join them and help them out.
Yeah, or even bring some coffee and donuts.
All right, we only have a couple minutes left. Let's tell people about the events happening this weekend.
Yeah. Once again, Scott Ritter tonight, 7:30, United Temple, United Methodist Church, 43rd and 15th Northeast.
Doors open at 6:30.
Doors open at 6:30, and it will be crowded. Get there early to get a seat. Tomorrow, lots of stuff going on. 1 o'clock, Volunteer Park. Be there. The march is at 3. Be going from Volunteer down to Westlake.
1 o'clock is the rally.
There will be another rally down at Westlake. Congressman Jim McDermott, freshly back from Iraq, will also be at Westlake that afternoon. He'll also be at Jefferson Park Community Center on Beacon Hill from 1 to 2:30. I should mention for the rally, for anybody who's confused, the weekly in my column, there was a copy editing error, and they misprinted the day as today. It is not today.
It is tomorrow.
There's actually a peacekeeping training at 1 o'clock today at Volunteer Park if you want to go do that, but the actual rally is tomorrow. Also, this coming Wednesday night, the Church Council of Greater Seattle has called for a march and candlelight vigil from United Methodist at 5th and Marion downtown up to St. James on Capitol Hill, and that will be at, I believe, 7 o'clock, 6:30. It's just been called in the last couple days. Stuff is being announced pretty much every day around town. The best place for updated information for all this is Gene Buskin's Peace Calendar, Gene being a longtime peace activist who was arrested a couple weeks ago in Senator Cantwell's office on this very issue. That can be found at www.scn.org/activism/calendar. Literally hundreds of listings.
All right.
And contact phone numbers and websites and all that good stuff.
Lots of good stuff.
Yeah. So, oh, and the Capitol Hill switchboard once again.
Quickly.
1-202-224-3121. And information on the phone numbers for all of the different congressional offices is available at the League of Women Voters website locally. And that website is www.scn.org, same as the other, /LWV Seattle, all one word.
Okay. With that, we are out of time. Talking once again with Joff Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors of Eat the State, and one of you tell us where they can find Eat the State.
You can find Eat the State all around town in coffee shops, bookstores, record stores, bars, restaurants.
Places where people eat.
Places where people gather. Also in the public libraries. We're also in the King County Public Library System. Hooray. And we come out.
The state, ironically enough.
We come out every other week. Our next issue will be out next Wednesday. You can find us on the web at www.eatthestate.org. That's eat the state, all one word, .org. And if you want to give us a call, have tips, or have comments on what we cover, our phone number is 903-9461. Is that right?
Yeah, 206. Yeah. And, 206. You know, also for volunteering, for donations, for story ideas, any of that kind of stuff, we're very open to people participating.